Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
Sometimes it's good to leave home, if only to remember who made you, where you're from, how you carry the scent of geranium and saddle soap, hoof trimmings and mock orange, unbidden, as you slide through another country with its noises and flavors, its precisions about gesture, what pasta tonight, what subjunctive right now, essential encounters, all astonishing, until missing my own people, avalanches down with a roar, a grief burning to sorrow. The days carry on, if you call it that. What remains, sharp tang of small moments, how delicately she eased her old dog out the door, how he wiped his face, stomping snow from his shoes. Out of hundreds of unknowable people, lazily streaming all this Sunday through Bologna's huge piazza, it's you we miss. Helen Wicks in the Delmarva Review, Volume 8, 2015. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. The program is in two parts today. The first is a discussion of Volume 8 of the Delmarva Review, a publication of the Eastern Shore Writers Association. This edition of the review, which has just become available, was published using the print on demand, or POD, method this year, and this publishing method will be the subject of the second segment of the program. To discuss the current issue of the Delmarva Review, we're pleased to have in the studio today Wilson Wyatt, executive editor, contributing poet Wendy Mittman Clark, fiction contributor Jamie Brown, and co-nonfiction editor George Merrill. And in the spirit of full disclosure, I'm bound to inform you that I am the fiction editor of the review. We're pleased to have all of you in the studio today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Wilson, you have a long history in the writing and publishing business. When did you first become involved with the Delmarva Review? And share a bit of historical background for us, if you would.
I joined an organization called the Eastern Shore Writers Association, who publishes the review. I joined them back in 2000, I think, in 5. And they were producing a literary review, which was members only. And it was a pleasant little piece that we all hoped would sell to the public, and we'd have lots and lots of writing from the members of the Eastern Shore writers community on the Delmarva. The reality was that we had a small number of writers that contributed, and we didn't sell anything, and the libraries were the only ones interested in having our work. But the writers themselves were very interested in what was published about them, so that was good.
The writers either purchased for friends and neighbors.
I don't think they purchased it. Actually, they took copies.
There's no
indication there was ever income. But the idea was still a good idea, and in 2007, we did a survey of writers across the Delmarva Peninsula, about 200 writers, and we asked the question, would you support a literary review that was a legitimate review open to all writers everywhere. So that means that you would be competing for space, in effect, with your work. Over 90% of the writers said yes. So we decided to change the review. I became in charge of the change as the founder of the new review. And the first year, we opened the doors in 2007 to submissions. And instead of getting no submissions and asking people to please, please come and send us your work, what we had were about 100 submissions from everywhere. And in fact, the first one that came in was actually from Denmark, and that was a little startling because we didn't know what we'd be facing. But it was a learning experience, if you will. Well, going from 100 writers back in 2008, which was the first publication, we now have submissions from about 1,000 writers and several thousand actual submissions when you include the poetry and fiction and nonfiction. So that's quite a step in only a handful of years. The work that we get in the current issue, we have 35 authors coming from 12 states and Canada, and a good representation from Maryland, Virginia, and Delaware.
Well, so a very, I think anyway, evocative cover as well, and that will be on the Delmarva Public Radio website. Describe the cover to us and tell us why such an evocative cover this issue.
That was not in the script, Hal. the cover shows a torso, a nude torso, if you will, of a it looks like a woman, but it could be a man. And that describes the feature of the Delmarva Review. We are featuring, actually, a transgender issue, which is Sue Ellen Thompson's very highly regarded book of poetry called They. And our poetry editor, Ann Caldwell, has a conversation up front in the book about the transgender issue. And it's really a remarkable treatment how poetry can treat transgender acceptance, if you will.
Well, our listeners can go to the Delmarva Public Radio website and see a photograph of the cover as well. And I invite all of you to do that, www.delmarvapublicradio.net. So even as you're listening to our broadcast this morning, if you're not driving somewhere, go to the website and look. I think it's an outstanding cover, Wilson, and I congratulate the Delmarva Review for it. You mentioned Ann Caldwell. She's the poetry editor of the review. Tell us, Ann couldn't be with us today, but tell us a little bit about Ann and her approach to selecting poetry and how she works as an editor of the review.
I'd be happy to. First of all, we have, for the audience, we have an editor basically that is responsible for each genre, poetry, fiction, and nonfiction. And as the overall executive editor, I look at the submissions that have been selected from each of the genre editors, and we make choices. Ann Caldwell, our poetry editor, has been poetry editor for several years, and she's an outstanding poet in her own right. But in addition to being a very fine poet, she is also a teacher. And I think teachers have a great ability to be editors. First of all, they start off with being able to handle lots and lots of submissions from their own students. They have to know what they're looking for in the papers that they grade. And with Ann Caldwell, She has suggested, and we do this in the review, and you can, people who see the current review will notice this. When we publish the poetry of a poet, we try to publish several poems to give an idea of the breadth and the voice of the poet, how well they handle the style, and how different the styles may end up being from the same poet. So Anne has been a great person to contribute. We're all volunteers, by the way. So she's promised to be editor again for poetry next year, and I promised to quadruple her salary.
Well, we have a poet with us today, and Wendy Mittman Clark is an excellent choice that that Anne made for this review. Now, Wendy, you've published nonfiction essays, and I remember well your closing essays when you were executive editor of Chesapeake Bay Magazine. In addition, you have a book of essays, I believe, titled Window on the Chesapeake Bay, The Bay, Its People, and Places. And now poetry. So we're going to ask you to read a couple of your poems in a moment, and then ask you when we're going to see your short story, and, so that you can cover all of the genres, if you would. One of your poems in the review is called "The Kiss," and "The Kiss" is actually famous in another light as well. Tell us about your poem, "The Kiss," and how you came to write this particular poem, and then we'd like for you to read it to us, if you would.
Okay, well, "The Kiss" came about because I just started writing poems last fall when I was taking a class with James Allen Hall, who teaches poetry at Washington College, where I'm taking my master's degree in English. And I had never thought that I could write poems, actually. And one of the prompts that he gave us was to write about a historical event, anything we wanted to. So I chose the photograph, the Alfred Eisenstadt photograph of VJ Day in Times Square. I think partly because I think a lot about my dad, who served in World War II in the Merchant Marine. And I just like to honor that era, those people, because I feel like they deserve that from us. And they are dying now. And it just seemed like a natural thing to do. So that's where the impetus came from to focus on.
Well, take a moment, if you would. And the photograph is famous. It was published, I think, in Life magazine, or even on the cover.
Not on the cover, but inside.
Certainly in Life magazine. And I remember seeing it when it came out, and I remember looking at it over the years. Tell us a little bit about the photograph, if you can, and what the photograph looks like for those younger generation who may not be quite acquainted with even Alfred Eisenstadt, unfortunately.
Right. Well, it takes place in Times Square, obviously, and in New York City, and it's a sailor, a Navy sailor, who has enveloped a nurse in his embrace, and she's literally, it's almost, you know, in dancing when you dip. She's arched sort of backwards. He's sort of over top of her. Her one leg, she's all in white, and one leg is sort of bent. I actually was reading about it again last night online, and one of the comments that I was sort of sad to read was that some people look at it now and see it as a sexual assault. Which I was sort of appalled to read that, but I'm not particularly surprised given our sensitivities these days. You know, in at that time in 1945, these people were coming out of years of war, and it was an expression of intense life, is how I see the photograph.
This event in Times Square was also a celebration. I mean, people were celebrating the victory.
Absolutely.
Over Japan. So I don't understand that comment either. Read the poem for
okay.
us, if you would.
Okay. The kiss. When I am kissed, I want to be kissed this way. Kissed like war is over. I want to drop my thin body arched like a dancer and falling into the unknown soldier's arms. I want my mouth open to the ravaged prayer of the survivor. When I am kissed, I want one knee folding, forgetting all it has carried on sensible, weary heels. I want my eyes closed to the bomb-lit ruins of innocence, the revelers in the street who stagger and dance and cry. When I am kissed, I want to be kissed this way, so that for a moment at least we yield to the wreckage of peace.
What is the wreckage of peace?
Well, you know, war was over, thank God, but then came after war. And nothing, you know, was easy. Mm-hmm. Women came back to a workforce that didn't exist for them anymore. Men were coming home, finding their homes completely changed, their society completely changed. And this is just the United States, let alone Europe. So I wanted to touch on the idea that obviously peace is a good thing, but it's a complicated thing.
You have a poem also called Gravity. Would you read that one for us as well? Because I find some kind of strange semblance between the two.
Okay, this is Gravity. At night in the meadow, we lay the blanket down and fall back to watch the stars in their endless migration find the unyielding geometry of distance. The tall grass of autumn does not tease our faces, nor does the dew wet our skin. Out here, we remain untouched, you and I, wheeling in our own orbits of intractable light years and the lambent echoes of stars long dead that burned and burned like we did. There should be comfort in the gravity that pins me to this blanket like a butterfly, wings ashen under the airless glass of this hurtling universe. There should be comfort in knowing I don't have to hold on.
I think that's a wonderful poem. I think they both are, and you're to be congratulated, Wendy, on them. Jamie Brown is with us also. Jamie Brown is editor of the Broadkill Review and also a fiction writer and contributor to the Delmarva Review. Jamie, tell us briefly, if you would, about the Broadkill Review and then your story, Thorns, in the current issue of the Delmarva Review.
The Broadkill Review is a PDF format literary journal distributed to nearly 10,000 people around the world. We can't pay you for your contributions, but obviously you get a lot of potential readers. We've been going now for 9 years. January, we will send out the first issue of year 10, that we publish 6 issues a year. If you'd like to get your name on our distribution list, you do not have to pay for a subscription, although we'd love it if you did. And you can send us an email at the_broadkill_review@earthlink.net. the_broadkill_review@earthlink.net.
Jamie, as I said, you're also an author, and you do write short stories, and you have one in the Delmarva Review called Thorns. tell us about Thorns and read a short section for us. If
sure.
You would.
The genesis of this story is that it grew out of a novella I wrote 30 years ago called Azaleas, which has not yet been published. But I was curious about what happened to the characters sometime on after. The story itself, Thorns, takes place in the late 80s and is related to the visit of a woman and her daughter, grown daughter, to the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. The woman's husband was killed in Vietnam before the daughter was born.
Before they were married.
Before they were married,
yeah, I believe. Yeah, well, it's fascinating. But read a section for us, if you would.
Well, we pick up with the mother, Adrian, at the memorial. Adrian was unaware of anything but the name chiseled into the polished black marble, Andrew Phillips. Her fingers, ungloved now, reached up to touch the letters of the name. Her eyes teared as she remembered how she had tried to convince him that he didn't know her, that she hadn't been honest with him, and how he wouldn't hear it, had just kept insisting that he loved her and wanted to marry her upon his return, how he had given her the engagement ring in trust, how she hadn't even accepted his proposal until, in a letter she wrote before she knew she was pregnant, she had written the words, "Yes, yes, yes, I miss you so," from her college dorm room desk. How she'd treasured the clover ring he'd once made for her, kept the sprig of azaleas he had cut for her hair, pressed and dried so as not to lose their color. Her lips trembled as she undid the catch of her purse and drew the fragile little dried cutting from its plastic bag and gingerly, gently, inserted the stem end into the joint of the two slabs at the point closest to his name. Annie approached her through the polite perimeter of people who had gathered as tourists to pay their respects and to stand in awe of just such microcosmic events. Adrian, oblivious to everything but his name, stood on the balls of her feet, leaned forward, and touched her lips to the letters. They gave back no warmth. "Andrew," she whispered. "Mom," Annie asked quietly, "are you okay?" Adrian turned, her cheeks glistening in the dusk. She struggled to speak, but no words came out. She lifted her hands, held them palms upward, shrugged, and opened her arms to her daughter, who rushed in, trying desperately to fill the void that was not hers to fill. Adrian cried, sobbing softly. "It was so stupid. They just kept sending them all off to die. I didn't know what to do." Annie, at 19, was already an inch taller than her mother and stroked Adrian's hair, saying softly, "It's okay, Mom. It's okay."
Beautiful writing, Jamie. Thank you. What happens here? We'll read it in the review, but they're at the memorial. They're sending the young men off to die.
You have to go to the memorial, spend some time, watch what happens, and you'll see exactly this sort of thing happen time and again. Less perhaps now, so many years later, but really.
Why the story, Jamie?
The characters just lived inside of me, needed to get out.
The memorial? Is there a special place for you, for the memorial?
No, but I have friends who have asked me to go and trace the names of comrades they lost in the war. So I've done that. I was, in fact, drafted late in the Vietnam War, but the federal government saw fit to send me to Alaska instead. And although a buddy of mine in MP school was going to Vietnam, he said, "You're going to be cold." And I said, "You know, nobody's going to be shooting at me. I can learn to like the cold."
I think your story is quite moving, and one of the reasons I feel that it's moving is very moving is because to some degree, the Vietnam War was our era.
Yes.
We're of the age that was kind of our
absolutely
our war.
Absolutely.
And Why the title Thorns?
It seems sometimes when you reach for a beautiful flower, you get stuck. There's pain sometimes amid the beauty.
And what's the beautiful flower in this story? I'm quizzing you here, but I like the story.
I think it's the relationship between the mother and the daughter. And the story is itself part of a larger planned novella, which would be a follow-on to the previous one, and contrast with the previous story, the relationship of Annie with her own soldier, who then goes off to the Middle East. Anyway.
Well, it's beautiful. Thank you.
Sure.
I was very pleased to read it in the review. George, you are well known to Delmarva Public Radio listeners. You broadcast a series of essays, two each month, I believe, on the WSCL, I think. Say a word to us about your essays, if you would, George, and then we'll ask you about choosing essays for the Delmarva Review.
Our thing to define in some ways is we all know, but I would say to you that what I look for mostly in my own essays and in those of others, somebody who can invite me into seeing something familiar in something new, and vice versa, being able to tease something new, seeing something new in what's familiar. And most of these essays that we received did that, and I was pleased that was able to happen. I want to...
But a word about your essays, George.
My essays are whatever it is that I happen to see from the corner of my eye. That's all it takes. And I sit down with it, and I look at it, and I turn it over, and I stretch it, and I either keep at it until I begin to see all kinds of weird things living in that corner of the eye experience, or the corner of the ear, those things that happen so transiently, they lay hold of you rather than something big and dramatic. So they sometimes seem playful, but they're also struggling for that irony.
And these essays in the Delmarva Review that you read, how do you judge, again, how do you evaluate them and decide which ones we want to put in?
I wish I could tell you that I was methodical, and I am not. Because my mind is totally incapable of being methodical. But I will tell you this. They are essays which, for some reason or another, activate something from the corner of my eye. And I would like to speak to two, just very briefly,
because
I know we have time.
No,
the
we're,
one is,
we're
I
good.
I never thought I would live long enough to be in a literary magazine that accepted from an author what he did on his summer vacation. And he pulls it off. It absolutely, in the world of poets and writers who are into the storm and the drang and the pain and the loss, this guy had a nice childhood and he enjoyed his summer vacation. And I think that probably is more unique than anything else we have in the business, because we're all in the business of, turning over the rocks. Well, and I'm not unwilling to do that either. And one really that touched me deeply is called... It's written by a woman named Shauna Irvin, and she is a woman who was sexually abused as a child. This in itself is very prevalent in literature today, and you want to be sensitive to it, but she does something which is exceptional. There is a camp that she is invited to. It's called Wish, and apparently it involves recreational activities which will help her to try to reconcile some of this pain and suffering and grief that she suffered. And what she does is fascinating. There was a psychiatric theory years ago called the object relations theory of personality. In short, it meant that when people are severely hurt when they're young, their world turns into the good guys and the bad guys. and they can't blend them. So no one person, if it's a parent or they can't see it. They're either good or they're bad. What you don't see in a lot of literature coming from sexual abuse is a woman who actually does come to terms with that, and her objects become together, and she loves that, which is, of course, the pain of the abuse is the love. If it wasn't that, it wouldn't be a problem. And that's what makes it so excruciating. Long and short of it, she says finally, after a series of exercises with the horses that they train with, that she develops a relationship to the horse, which she also had a relationship with the horses because her father was active in some kind of horse activity. But at the end of the day, she says this, and this is what grabbed me from the corner of my eye. It was easier to hate my dad, every part of him, even the parts we had shared. I wanted to wipe him from my DNA, wipe away who I had been before his tenderness had transformed special into shame. To accept myself, I had to accept our shared love for horses and let myself enjoy the connection with a horse, both with and without my dad's DNA. I had to love the pieces of my dad that were part of me. I had to love myself and learn how to connect. That is an extraordinary statement coming from somebody who has been hurt so deeply. And that's really what captured my imagination. And I thought she had traveled her journey with a considerable amount of grace and I suppose good fortune.
A beautiful essay, frankly. And I think the learning how to deal with the mixture that the world presents to us, even in our closest friends and our relatives, is really amazing in that story. Well, Wendy Mittman Clark, Jamie Brown, and George Merrill, thank you for being with us today to discuss this current issue of the Delmarva Review. And for your contribution, Jamie and Wendy, to this issue as well, your talent and your work is just greatly appreciated.
It's an honor.
We're going to take a short break now, and when we come back, Wilson Wyatt will be joined by authors Bill Gorgie and Neil Gillen to discuss what's new in the publishing world, and in particular, how you can publish your own work. This is Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. Please stay with us.
Hope you can join us this Friday at 9 for Vintage Country. We're going to be doing a theme about all those things that are still in your refrigerator that are going to end up in your stomach. At the top of the second hour, we're going to do the top 10 from 1967. That's Vintage Country, WSDL.
Welcome back to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. We're going to talk about what's new in publishing, and particularly the most effective, economical, and quickest way for you to get your memoirs and that novel you've been working on published and into the public's hands. I'm joined today by Wilson Wyatt, executive editor of the Delmarva Review, Neil Gillen, author of a number of books, including How to Publish Now, Publisher's Comparison Guide, and Bill Gorgie, poet, science fiction writer, and managing editor of the Delmarva Review. Wilson, let me begin with you. How has publishing changed over the past few years, and And what does that mean for those of us who would like to see our work in print, or if not in print, at least in someone else's hands and before someone else's eye?
Well, the really good news is that everyone can publish something today, and they can do it very inexpensively and effectively. You can have your own book right in your own home. There is no reason why anyone can't do it, and that's the good news. And the result is that you have hundreds of thousands of new books this year that have been published. You've heard the term e-books, and of course that's part of it. At the Delmarva Review, which, and this is something that Bill Gorgie is going to talk about a little more, is we use something called publish on demand, which means that a printed book can actually be delivered to your home in only a few days, and it's pretty remarkable. But just to point out how different the world is, some people have said in the past that if you publish your own book, it's not very good, and you know it's looked at as vanity press, quote unquote. You don't hear the word vanity press much anymore. It's becoming something almost obsolete, if you will. Of published authors, 70% of all published authors actually prefer to self-publish. These are authors that have published traditionally with books, but they prefer self-publishing, and the reason is they have control over the publishing process. And that's the most popular reason. But otherwise, this has enabled anyone with an idea for a story to be able to produce a book. And I'll leave it at that point, because I think that if you're a writer listening to this show, this means you have an opportunity. It's not that it's easy, but you can do it, and you can do it inexpensively.
And we're going to talk about it a little later, Wilson, but the Delmarva Review was published, as I think you said, on the print-on-demand, using the print-on-demand process.
That's correct. We used to actually go to a printing company and bid it out for publishing. The process took a couple of weeks, and you saw blue lines and all the old-fashioned terms. Someone like me, who's a reporter, can remember setting type in lead print. We don't have to do that anymore. But what has happened since then is we have gone the route of publish on demand, where we send a digital book to the printer, and I can attest to the fact that we can have a copy in our hands to look at within 2 days.
Well, we're going to talk about that process in a little bit more depth. But let me mention that our listeners can go to the Delmarva Public Radio website, www.delmarvapublicradio.net, and see a copy of the Delmarva Review that was published on print on demand. And you can see that it looks like any book that you could have bought 5 years ago or 10 years ago. It's an excellent, to my mind, an excellent piece of work. And they can see a picture, plus our evocative title, our evocative photograph that That is the cover. One other question for you, Wilson. The a large part of publishing your book is marketing your book, and I know that once we go through the publishing process and you've got a book in your hand, you've got to get it in the hand of your readers or your would-be readers. I would sense that is a very, very large topic in itself, the marketing. But if you publish your own book, as an example, give us just a hint about how the marketing would work.
Okay, and I'll also make the point that it doesn't really matter if you publish traditionally or you self-publish. Marketing is really the same. You know, most publishing companies have a small marketing division. They have some good ideas that they have copied for you, maybe, and you'll be on your way to sitting there at bookstores to sign books. Basically, there's no difference, except that when you print your own book, you have to assume that you are going to do all marketing. And usually that's about a third of the process. So one third is writing the book and making sure it's the best possible book you can possibly write, and edited it over and over again. So then it's to publish it. And then the other third is to market the book. That is a whole industry. There are people who can help you do it. And maybe someday we'll do a show just for you on that subject.
Oh, well, I think exactly. we will have to do a program on marketing. But right now, let's focus on getting the book. Book on the table. And then we'll get it sold. Let me ask Neil if you would please tell us about your book, How to Publish Now, Publisher's Comparison Guide.
Well, it's available on CreateSpace and Amazon for $11.99. That's the most.
Speaking of marketing.
Yes, that's the most important thing to bring out. Or on my website, neilpgillenbooks.com. The seminal beginnings of the book really took place a few years ago when Wilson and I were planning the initial Publish Now conference at the Writers Center. And Wilson, who attends numerous conferences and has over the years, probably knows more about the changes in the publishing industry in recent years. He asked me, given my experience in self-publishing, if I could tackle the cost factors and also the preparation factors of getting your book together. And so I put together an hour lecture to the 150 students, attendees we had there. And as a result, I received a lot of positive follow-up and emails after I sent everyone the slides. And thereafter, some people actually followed my advice and successfully published in a very efficient and economical manner. Wilson and Bill can tell you that there are many horror stories in the self-publishing field. And what I set out to do is to, you know, demonstrate how to prepare a manuscript for publication, how to publish efficiently at a minimum cost. And I reviewed over 25 print-on-demand publishers and an in-depth analysis of the cost involved for editing, proofreading, design, and publication, which is all that one-third publication issues. I looked at each one of these publishers, various costs and the services which they offer, and I alert the reader to the services to avoid, which some of them go into up to $20,000 in these packages, and people have been hooked. And I, as a result, I suggest appropriate publishers you might select, and I did the economics of using a model of 100 books published and the cost involved to have it published, the book pricing and the royalty rates, and recommended narrowed down the publishers that you should consider to use.
So that's in your that's in your book.
Yes, it's all in the book.
Neil.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I take each reader to the site of the print-on-demand publisher, provide the website where they can go to and see the services offered and the cost of the various packages, which range from, aside from CreateSpace, which you can do for virtually no cost, to the prices then range from $500 up to about $1,200 for the basic package, which gives you a 6x9 book with a glossy cover, a black and white interior.
Neil, what is that? We're going to talk about in a few moments how the Delmarva Review was put together using print on demand. What are some of these other methods that you're mentioning, and how do they work?
Okay, Wilson mentioned some of them. There, I do review a few publishers who are really printers, because what they offer you is a volume package, 100 books for such and such. 200 books for such and such, and those prices average about $6.50 to $8 a book. If you go from a 200-page book, is going to cost about $7. But if you do it on CreateSpace, a 200-page book will cost you about $2.15 for you to purchase.
So it would seem that would have a significant impact on the price of the book that you're going to have to charge as well.
The most important thing you can learn from my book is what will a print-on-demand publisher charge you to buy your own book? Because most of the self-published books are sold by the authors, and they're sold to friends and fellow employees, relatives. And if they're really good at marketing, and they can get out to the book clubs and the Friends of the Library meetings and to the Gaithersburg and various book fairs that are out there, or if they really have a lot of talent in selling, they can go into the internet world and market their book on LinkedIn, on Facebook, on Google. That comes with a cost, though. Yeah.
Well, let's just say I've got a pile of maybe 180, 250 pages of 8.5 by 11 paper that's come out of my printer. That is my book. What do I do with it?
Well, the first thing you do is employ. First thing you have to understand, you're entering the publishing business, and before you do, you have to have a budget. And included in that budget are the cost of an editor and a proofreader.
So I've got to have my work edited. Are the editor and the proofreader the same thing?
No, they're not.
How do they differ, Neil?
The editor is going to review your story, the arcs of your story, its setting, its characters, its dialogue. They're going to tell you whether or not the story works. Does it flow? Is the tension resolved too easily? Does it enthrall the reader?
How much is that going to cost me for an editor?
A good editor, if I give a plug for Barbara Essman, who has edited 8 of my books, she charges $50 an hour. Some charge by the page, but there are websites, which I mentioned in my book, where you can go to get editors. But essentially, each writing magazine at the back of the Writer's Digest or any other literary magazine has advertising for editors. A proofreader is different. They're going to check for spelling. Are the dates correct? Are the characters, or if you mention, say, President Reagan, they're going to check to see whether you spelled it R-E-A, G-A-N or R-E-G-A-N. That's a proofreader's, and whether the capitalization is correct. An editor will not touch that. A proofreader will. So there's a big difference. So now you've had your book edited. It works right. Had it proofread. Now you have to select a publisher. And in selecting a publisher, there are three important factors. The cost to publish your book, the pricing of your book, as I stated before, and the royalty rate. And in How to Publish Now, I review all of these factors and narrow them down so to make your choice easier.
Well, let me ask you, Bill. You handled the we can call it publishing or the creation of this hard. Well, it's actually a paperback book, but it's something I can hold in my hand and sit by the fire this winter and flip through and read. What was the process you went through and how did you make your decisions?
Well, let's see, a couple things. First,
and remember, as you go through this, I'm sitting here with my 180 to 250 pages, and I want to figure out what to do with it, right?
Well, the first thing is don't use your printer, because the world is digital, especially the world of print on demand and any publishing. Even though it says print in the print on demand title, POD, everything leading up to the printing is digital. So that's probably the first thing. You know, both Wilson and Neil are right in that the cost of being able to print your own book is cheap. It really is. So the technicals are cheap, but it requires some technical savvy and elbow grease if you're not going to hire somebody to do it for you. And that, I think, is the important part there. So, for example, with the Delmarva Review, we are fortunate enough to have an editorial team that on a volunteer basis compensates for those costs, those editing costs that Neil was talking about before. You know, for a 300-page book, it'll run you $1,500 to get it appropriately edited. And usually editing starts with the developmental editing that Neil was talking about, where the editor is looking for things like story arc and theme, character consistency, scene consistency, things like that. But then you get into line editing, which is, how well do the paragraph or the paragraph structured and do the sentences flow and that sort of thing. And then copy editing, which is the proofreading that Neil was talking about, which usually involves someone who knows a little something about the Chicago Manual of Style and checking for all those inconsistencies. That adds up. I mean, that's not inexpensive.
Well, I was just going to say that sounds terribly expensive, right? To me, frankly.
And what's important is that the technics of publishing a book are certainly very cheap. In fact, really, the cost of printing the Delmarva Review, because we do have a volunteer staff, was literally the cost of the first proof, which was, with shipping, about $10. However, many, many hours of work were put in editing it, making sure, choosing the
pieces. Who edited the review?
Well, I think Wilson led the charge on all of the editing. So as
you edited, how did you go about editing the review, Wilson?
You start with page one. You read every word, every sentence, and you start working through it. And then we have a copy editor that we ran the whole book through, and she did a cut.
Right.
And then after that, we had a proofreading exercise, and that was, and all of this is done, pretty much all of that was done by volunteers and a team. We have a great team. And I would say to Bill's point, I would say the total number of hours in the Delmarva Review is in the hundreds of hours.
Yeah.
of volunteer time by volunteers from the Eastern Shore Writers Association.
So as a, you know, in order to publish it, you know, the way I think of self-publishing is like any good tradesperson, you have your toolkit. And the toolkit involves your whatever you have on your laptop or desktop machine. For many, it's Microsoft Word. For others who like prefer the Mac platform, it might be Pages. But you have to have something that you can use to create and format your document. And the more you know about formatting, the easier it is to generate the files that you need for print-on-demand publishing. So there's certain formats. If you go to CreateSpace or Ingram, you know, or any of the other services that will print for you, they require getting the copy, the interior and the exterior, the cover, in certain format. The more you know about how to actually set up your manuscript in that tool that you're using, the easier it is.
And cheaper.
And cheaper, right, and cheaper. So simple little things like using in Microsoft Word headings for the chapter headings, meaning a heading style as opposed to a body style. I mean, you know, it's technical. It's technical, and you need to understand those kinds of nuances, and then it makes your life a whole lot easier.
So the editor, you're referring basically to the design characteristics
exactly.
of the print. No, the book. Who does the design characteristics? That's not the editor, is it? Is that still another person that you have to have to do the design?
You can do it yourself, or like CreateSpace will assign for a price. I think it's $350. They'll assign a design team, and they'll offer you a selection of designs. Which include all the things Bill referred to, how to set up your chapter headings, the titles. Are you going to do Roman numerals or Arabic numerals, or are you going to spell out the number, the chapter number?
Fonts, I mean,
The font, the spacing.
Right.
At the Delmarva Review, we did all that ourselves.
Yeah.
We didn't pay for that. That's what I mean. I mean, it was, you know, I'll set it up. I'll turn it over to Bill. Bill's going to be taking the format that we've gotten, the page numbers, the chapters, the table of contents, all of that, which I do. Bill then converts it with CreateSpace into a book.
Right, and it's broken into two parts: the interior and the cover. So to produce a high quality interior. If you know how to do everything yourself, it's just a matter of time and having the tools to do it. And, you know, you can do it for virtually nothing. It's the cost of your labor. However, if you want to do it right, as if you're thinking in terms of self-publishing for our audience here, you do have to pay for the editor, as we discussed. That can run you, let's call it $1,500 to $2,000 for a few hundred page book to get all the appropriate editing and proofreading done.
I wouldn't say that high. You could do it for 200 page book, possibly no more than $1,000.
And how do you find this editor? You mentioned one person, I know, Barbara Essman, but how do you find your editor?
Well, for Eastern Shore writers members, there are very capable people who have experience in the publishing industry who will render these services for you. And so they're available. And there are also websites where you can find them. And as I said before, in the literary magazines in the back of the book, there are people who advertise as editors, or in the event guide for the Writers' Center, there are people who offer their services, or you can call any university we're right here at Salisbury University. I'm sure in the English department or the literature department, there are very capable people who perform those services.
How do I keep from getting taken by by an editor that I don't know, that I find in an advertisement or...
Well, what you want to do is ask for their references. Ask for references for writers that they have performed services for who have been published. And then contact them and find out what kind of product they delivered. Did the manuscript come back in annotated form? Was there a roadmap in the form of a memorandum explaining what was right with the story, what was right or wrong with the characters, what was right or wrong with the setting or the dialogue? That's what an editor does. You have to check them out just like you're checking. This person is going to be working for you. Right. They're your employee. You want to make sure that they can deliver.
Wilson.
Yeah, I'll add to that to what Neil said by saying one of the greatest things you can do is network, and one of the greatest places to network on the Delmarva Peninsula is the Eastern Shore Writers Association. There's another one in Rehoboth Beach, another organization. By going to meetings like that and triangulating and talking to other authors, you can ask these questions and you will get answers. And you will find people, good editors, for your kind of book. And keep in mind that an editor for a crime novel is going to be very different from the editor of a literary novel.
That's really a good point, Wilson. So you want to find the right editor for the kind of work that you want to produce.
That's extremely important. A genre, not just genre, but audience-specific editor is important. You don't want somebody who edits memoirs, editing your young adult, young adult thriller. I mean, it's just there are diverse editors out there, but usually it's not a good match. Mm-hmm. You want somebody who understands the young adult audience. The best advice I could provide for our audience here today is to think of self-publishing as a marathon, not a sprint. So you might sprint to get your book out the door. And what's good about self-publishing is because you are more in control of the process, the timeline is usually a lot faster. So to get a novel published traditionally, between the time it takes to find an agent, the agent then to sell it to a publishing house, the publishing house then to edit it and then put it on their publishing schedule and get it out the door, take as long as 2 years. Whereas if you have a finished manuscript and access to an editor to begin the editing work, you could actually have it out the door in a matter of a couple months, good soup to nuts. So the timeline is faster for the actual publishing event, but then the marathon starts, which is all of the marketing that's involved, selling your book, getting to book fairs. If you're in it for the long haul and you have some other books that you want to produce, doing it over again, continuing to build your brand, developing a website, putting together ad copy, all those things that both Neil and Wilson were talking about are part of the marathon. That's really important. For the Delmarva Review, that's one of the challenges that we work on is the publicity around it, getting it out on wonderful shows like this today, so that people hear about it, know about it, and, can spread the word.
What I find very interesting is that writers tend to be, literary writers at any rate, tend to be very solitary people. They sit and they write and they think and they invent and they create images. And that is a very solitary activity. Believe me, I know that, and I know you do too, that it's a solitary. What you're saying, though, is that all of a sudden you have to shift gears and you have to become an outside person. You have to now start dealing with all of these people out here about your work. Other than a publisher, is there somebody who'll do that for you?
Well, maybe it's a psychologist. because because really the truth is, and I've watched this, and Neil is here in the with us, and I've watched Neil Gillen at work at book fairs, and because he and I have been at a number of book fairs with our books. A person needs to go to a book fair or any place with the mood of selling. You've got to have an attitude, I'm going to sell this book. And when someone walks up to you and wants to know more about your book, you have to have one thing in mind. I'm going to sell this book to this person. Because if you don't have that intuitive psychology, it's not going to happen. You can't sit there in a chair and smile at people that walk by, because they're going to do one thing, walk by. And so selling is very important.
So you have to be a salesman.
You do. And that's a whole other subject.
You have to close the deal.
You got to close the deal. Well, some of us are trying to write the last page of our great American novel. Wilson Wyatt, Neil Gillen, Bill Gorgie, thank you for being with us today on Delmarva Today Writers Edition, and for sharing your insights with us. Okay, all of you writers out there, you've heard the daunting word here. There are no excuses now. Get that book finished, do your research, and get it out to your readers. And to all of you, thank you for listening today. I'm your host, Harold Wilson, and this is Delmarva Today, Writers Edition.
You've been listening to a special Writers Edition of Delmarva Today with their host, Harold Wilson. This program is produced on the campus of Salisbury University for Delmarva Public Radio. Christopher Rank is your audio engineer. Mary Seaman is the volunteer producer. Visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, for podcasts of this program.